Good day. Welcome to UCT Law at Work series of podcasts. I'm your host, Irena Wasserfall. Today we'll be chatting with Associate Professor Andrew Hutchison of the Faculty of Law at UCT. Andrew is a contract specialist and has published a body of work in leading South African and international peer-reviewed law journals and edited books on contract law. A theme running through most of these articles is the role to be given to good faith or fairness in South African contract law. Dr. Hutchison is interested in the comparative and historical angles to this question, as well as the constitutional and relational dimensions. Andrew is currently engaged in research on financial inclusion and stokvels in Cape Town, South Africa. Welcome, Andrew. Thank you very much for participating.
Thanks, Irena. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful having you. Let's jump right in and ask you a couple of questions about stokvels, because I found this very interesting subject matter. Many of us have heard the word stokvel. So what exactly is it, and how does it differ from a pyramid scheme, for example?
Sure, thanks. Thanks, Irena. That's a good question. And actually, there's a link between those two. But let me start from nuts and bolts and spell it out from scratch. So a stokvel will probably be well known to anyone who's lived in South Africa for a period of time. So a stokvel is a form of association. It's an informal club, usually with a purpose of saving money or obtaining credit. Of course, there are many different kinds of stokvels, which no doubt we'll get into in due course. But we'll just start from this nuts and bolts definition that it's a club with a purpose of saving and maybe for obtaining credit. So it's an informal version. You do get formalized versions of clubs with similar purposes. So in the global north, people talk about credit unions, which are basically the same idea, but normally under a clear regulatory structure. You know, there'll be a statutory regime governing them. And of course, we have those here too. So we have what they call cooperative financial institutions, cooperative banks, that kind of thing. So that's a similar idea to a stokvel, but I consider it different because it's a formal structure under the Reserve Bank and clearly regulated. So back to stokvels. With a stokvel, it'll be a club, normally of friends, neighbors, relatives, people who live on the same street. People will pay money in, often at a meeting, which will happen on a regular basis. Normally, there's a constitution agreed to by members, which sets the rules for the club. You know, how often meetings are gonna happen, what the contribution will be, how it'll work, what the rules of the club are, fines, that sort of thing. And often there'll be an entertainment function. So if the club, let's say, meets on the first Saturday of every month, and maybe someone gets paid at that meeting from the pot that everyone's contributed to, then maybe after the formal proceedings, then there'll be a bit of a party where maybe some food is eaten and some drinks. Who knows? There's different kinds of people and different kinds of stokvels. But in our research, we attended a party afterwards, which was quite an event at a tavern. So it can be a lot of fun, I think.
It's almost a social type of arrangement afterwards when you've done the business, get together and chat and socialize with each other.
Yeah, totally, totally. This is friends and neighbors, right? So it's got a serious purpose. It's about building wealth. It's about obtaining credit. It's about helping you in your time of need. But it's also about having a good time and getting together with your friends. So that's
partying.
Yeah,
partying with a purpose.
Indeed. So that's the first part of your question. What is a stokvel? And then to deal with the pyramid scheme. So pyramid schemes, you know, are well known to us. So we've all received these in the past. A pyramid scheme is basically the idea is that a group of people will start it and they'll get members of the public to join. And upon joining, there's normally some sort of subscription. If it's a money one, if it's a pyramid scheme with a money purpose, then you'll have to pay money to buy into the scheme. Normally, under understanding that you will then yourself get new people to join who will then pay in more money, and that somewhere down the line, you'll receive a big payout. You see these sort of schemes all over the place. There's ones with books where you join, you buy books, and then send them to names, and then people will later send to you. Normally, pyramid schemes, of course, are fraudulent, or if not fraudulent, then you know, it doesn't normally work out unless you're the person who happens to be starting it. And financial pyramid schemes are also illegal in South Africa. So the link, so that's obviously completely different to what I described with the Stokvel, which is an indigenous, a vernacular form of savings club between friends and neighbors who are often well known to each other, loyal in close bonds, want to help each other out. Of course, not all Stokvels are like that. So there was a scandal that went around last year called WhatsApp Stokvel, where you would be invited to join a WhatsApp group that was supposedly a Stokvel, and you'd have to pay, I think it was 200 Rand to join, and supposedly somewhere down the line, thousands would be paid out to you after, you know, you'd suckered your friends and neighbors to also join and also pay the money, which, you know, according to reports in the media, left a lot of people with egg on their faces, because after they'd persuaded their nearest and dearest to join and also pay money, then, you know, the group suddenly evaporated and there was no one legitimate that they could hold in charge. And of course, that is a pyramid scheme. That's a fraudulent pyramid scheme, which is illegal. And that's nothing like what a traditional Stokvel is supposed to work like.
Yes, I think people, members of the public, should realize that if something is too good to be true, then it normally is too good to be true. You know, person can't expect to invest 200 Rand and get thousands out of it. It just doesn't work like that. But the Stokvel seems to work on a really different basis. So you've explained to us what a Stokvel is, and you mentioned that there were different types of Stokvels. Could you give us a couple of ideas of what types of Stokvels they exist?
Yeah. So, like I said at the start, so we did some field work in Khayelitsha. We spoke to 20 members of individual members of Stokvels and held two focus groups. So that's where my information comes from, as well as the fairly extensive literature in South Africa that I've read on this. So what we got from our data was that I mentioned the constitution, and that would have a rule and a contribution scheme. And that constitution would set the blueprint for what the purpose of the Stokvel is and how it operated. And of course, seeing as I said, they're informal and unregulated, there's about as many different kinds of purposes and types of Stokvels as human ingenuity can conceive. But anthropologists do define certain broad categories. And once, you know, in our data set, certainly they fell into these categories. And I think that when you think about it, most Stokvels will fit into these. So I'm going to outline three big categories, and people listening can think about whether Stokvels they know fall into one of these categories. So the classic Stokvel is what they call in anthropology a ROSCA, R-O-S-C-A, a rotating savings and credit association. So a ROSCA might be this. So let's say that there are 10 of us in this club, and we each agree that from January onwards, each of us are going to pay 1,000 Rand into a common pot once a month. And then, so that's only 10 of us. And then maybe over November and December, we take a bit of a holiday because Christmas is expensive. So January to October, we each pay 1,000 Rand, and the 10 of us, and we have agreed at the outset what our order is going to be. So Ms. X, who's maybe one of the older, more senior members of the club, very well trusted and known to everyone, maybe she gets in January. So Ms. X is very lucky because Ms. X pays in 1,000 Rand in January and she gets 10,000 Rand out. And it's only by contributing from February to October that she'll pay down on that until she's paid off fully up until 10,000 Rand. So Ms. X then gets an interest-free loan from all the other members of 9,000 Rand, having put in only 1,000 Rand. And each other member will then take a turn according to the agreed roster until October, when let's call her Ms. Z, who might be a new member or a more junior member or someone who people are a little bit more uneasy about because she maybe hasn't proved her reliability yet, will then get the last payment. Yes. And it's only Ms. Z, the last person in the line, who won't receive a loan. Everyone before her will receive at least some sort of interest-free loan. In our data sample, in the ROSCAs, because of the way it was, you know, there was smaller groups where it would be more trusted people, and you know that it was quite a secure structure. People were putting quite large amounts of money into the ROSCAs. So, in the people that we spoke to, who were mostly fairly low-income people in Khayelitsha earning probably about 5,000 rand a month or so. Well, that's what they reported in our written survey. People were putting 1,000 rand a month in these, 2,000, 3,000. Some people who probably earned a bit more than 5,000 rand a month were putting as much as 5,000 in. And that means that when your turn comes, you know, you could be getting anywhere between 50,000 rand and even more. You know, people were buying cars with their Rosca payouts or building onto their houses. Quite a way to accumulate, you know, a large amount of capital by disciplined saving.
Wow, that's actually fantastic.
Yeah, so that's the Rosca, the rotating stock fell. Another kind is what they call an ASCRA in the literature, so A-S-C-R-A. So an ASCRA is an accumulating savings and credit association. In Khayelitsha, people call these simply a saving stokvel. So with a saving stokvel, it would be the same pattern. So we might agree, let's say the same 10 of us are going to contribute for 10 months, January to October. The amounts are normally a bit smaller in these. So not like the amounts that we heard were like 200 Rand or 400 Rand. So maybe we put 200 Rand in each month into the common pot, all of us. And we do that from January to October. But unlike the rotating savings one, instead of some person being paid every month at the monthly meeting, with an ASCRA, we'd all agree that, right, you know, 31st of October is the payout date, and everyone gets paid at that date, you know, their share of the pot. And with that one, of course, you've got capital on hand, which firstly could be banked, and a lot of banks often offer a special stokvel savings account where you can sign up, put your funds in the bank, and then you earn interest. You earn the security of storing your money there. You can maybe transfer by EFTs, that kind of thing. And it also meant that there's a pool of capital on hand for lending. So ASCRAs often lend, normally only to members, but a member could take a loan, normally at an interest rate. So the average interest rate we heard in our sample was about 30% per month on a simple basis, so no interest on interest. You take a 100 Rand loan, you pay 130 Rand back in a month's time. In 2 months' time, it'll be 160 Rand, like that. And then the interest goes back into the pot, and according to the rules of the stokvel, it might be that everyone shares equally in accumulated interest, or it might be that, you know, if you can grow the pot by lending, then the interest accrues that you earn accrues to you only. And there are many different ways of cooking the books in this. So one, people often lend to outside non-members of the stokvel, which means you get the external capital flowing into your common pot in the form of interest, which provides access to credit for non-members and you know the interest income for members. Another purpose we heard of these was that you run, let's say our 10 members are running a Rosca and an ASCRA. That way, the risk of someone, because the Rosca, remember, is an interest-free loan. So remember, let's say you paid in February and you've now got your 10,000 Rand out and you owe still, what will that be, 7,000 Rand to, you know, to different members. But if you got your ASCRA, then there's collateral because you're paying in that each month and not drawing out. So if you default before the end of the stokvel cycle, maybe the ASCRA money can be used to settle a balance that is owing to other members. So there's very clever ways that people use these different clubs as financial security.
And do you sorry, I'm interrupting. I just wanted to know, it looks to me like ROSCAs are smaller groups of people, where ASCRAs are more, can be hundreds or thousands of people. But if you're going to have a rotating stokvel, it seems administratively it would be better to keep it to a smaller group of people.
We found normally that ROSCAs, the number of members in a ROSCA was somehow tied to an annual cycle. So with 12 months, you know, the best number of members would be 12 or 10 or something. But you could maybe have six and everyone takes twice in a cycle, in an annual cycle. Or have 24, and then you pay two people each month. But normally the groups were smaller, whereas with an ASCRA, because it's basically just a collective savings scheme, you could have any number of members. And we found some quite big ASCRAs. People were, one person said they had like 90 members of their ASCRA. One person said that theirs was on WhatsApp, you know, hopefully not a pyramid scheme WhatsApp one, but a WhatsApp group. And there were so many members, they actually weren't sure how many members there were. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Were there any other kinds of?
Yeah. And then there's a third type, which we actually didn't study in our data set, but which, you know, which are well reported in the literature and which I have a student working on, and that's the burial society. So a burial society has a risk management function, I would say, in that you would belong to a burial society to help you make provision for a funeral. Funerals are a cultural expense. It's, you know, well documented that when a funeral occurs, that can impose quite a heavy cost burden on the family where the person has died, in terms of having to host an event and cater for everyone and pay for the burial of the body, or maybe the repatriation of the body to the Eastern Cape or wherever an ancestral homeland is. And that a burial society, you would belong to it. You would also contribute on probably a monthly basis or whatever the periodic basis works. And that you would obtain cover according to the rules of the club for yourself, or maybe nominated lives, you know, named persons who were also covered.
Yes.
And that the club, when one of these covered lives died, the club would either make a monetary contribution or a contribution in kind, maybe catering for the funeral or provide assistance in catering for the funeral. And then also, interestingly enough, that funeral insurance is big business in South Africa. So we took a walk around Khayelitsha Mall, which is next to the train station. And when you walk over the bridge over the train station, you know, there's the informal trader selling fruit, and there's the informal trader, you know, selling other knickknacks. And then there's Dove or funeral parlors, or even insurers have their little informal, you know, trader stall and umbrella, and they're selling funeral insurance. And you know, whenever you go to a bank, they're like, everyone is getting in on the action. And we didn't speak much about this, but one or two people mentioned that, you know, they were part of a burial society, and then they also had an insurance policy with a formal sector insurer. So, yeah, it's the number one risk that people want to insure in this country.
Because I can imagine that can get quite complicated, you know, determining what the actual rules in the constitution would be, because yeah, you're dealing with five people in one family, for example, and three of them pass away in a shack fire, whereas other people are just a man and wife, perhaps, and, you know, just one person passes away. So I imagine the Constitution would have to really put the rules set out the rules quite nicely so that all these contingencies are covered.
Yeah, I mean, anything to do with insurance would normally involve heavy statistical work and financial planning and stuff. There's a very good paper on this by Thompson and Posel. I don't know the citation details offhand, but Thompson is an actuary and Posel is a social scientist. And they did an empirical study of a whole lot of burial societies looking at their actuarial practices and how well they had planned for the contingency of, you know, for example, a whole lot of simultaneous deaths or. And they found out the planning was actually pretty good, but yeah, it's an interesting way in which a financial function needed in modern society has been appropriated and adapted by indigenous culture into their own form of insurance practice.
That's actually fascinating. Andrew, tell me, it looks like a lot of this stuff happens by means of the exchange of cash money. Did you find that a lot of the stuff was handled in cash only, or did a large amount of these kind of savings and different types of stock fails also involve banking?
Yeah, so I don't have those statistics to hand, but we did cover this in our data, and I think I discussed it in one or more of the things I wrote. But we found that certainly, the majority of the stokvels that we looked at had a stokvel, like a joint club account, and many banks are offering this. So Nedbank has probably one of the best known ones, but most of the banks have some sort of club account aimed at stokvels. And then, depending on the nature of the members, you know, whether they're younger, wealthier, whatever the case may be. Quite a lot of the members had their own personal bank account as well. So, I mean, Finmark Trust have done surveys on this over the years. And I think the most recent one I saw said that about 80% of South Africans are financially included in the sense that they have a bank account.
Yes.
And that's where maybe their salary would be paid or something like that. And in our sample as well, we found that quite a lot of Stokvels, certainly the meeting we attended, the members there were mostly men, mostly yes. younger men, comparatively quite affluent younger men. And there the contributions had to be paid by EFT to the receiving member. So you would pay your 1,000 rand or whatever your contribution was to the member who was going to receive it, and then send proof of payment to that person. And that was how they transacted, was online. Whereas we spoke to an older woman, and she said that her Stokvel was cash. There was a bowl on the table, and everyone put their cash in there. And so you get both, and it'll depend on the kind of person involved.
Yeah, I imagine the younger ones would be more tech savvy, definitely.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, would you say that Stokvels are an informal form of social security?
Yes, I think so. So, let's unpack what you mean by social security. So, social security from the government is a way of protecting people from falling through the cracks, in the sense that when something unexpected happened to you, like maybe unemployment or an unexpected event which imposed a cost on you, that if it was the state as a social insurer, that they would provide a cover for you. So in the Stokvels we looked at, we did see this a bit. For example, so remember we looked at Roskas and Askras, so basically at savings and at credit Stokvels, and we found that with some of these Stokvels there was provision that, you know, if there was maybe a death in your family and you suddenly had to travel to the Eastern Cape at short notice, that things could be done, like maybe a collection could be taken up on a once-off basis. Well, not on a once-off, because it would have to then be for each person in the club so that it was fair and it came out in the wash, but that an ad hoc collection could be taken, and it's in that way you could obtain an interest-free loan from other members of the club as needed. People also said maybe that you could, if you were a rotating Stokvel, swap turns. So instead of being in October, you could maybe be in March because you needed your payout now, which would then be negotiated probably with the person who was going to receive in March. Yeah, of course, if it's an ASCRA and there's a lending function, you could take a loan from your Stokvel, which would have the advantage then of, so sure, these loans weren't free. You would have to pay quite high interest, but you would avoid all the red tape under the National Credit Act. So if you went to what they call in this country a micro lender or a bank and tried to borrow money, assuming you didn't have a credit card, which most people in our sample wouldn't have had that, they would have to do an affordability assessment on you, which is required under the National Credit Act to avoid reckless lending. If you were credit blacklisted, for example, in other words, you know, with the credit bureau, there was adverse information against you, it would be hard to get that loan. You'd have to travel somewhere to go and speak to the lender to get this. Whereas with the Stokvel, it's your buddies. You know, they live on your street. You get the money easily. And for some people, paying a high interest rate was worth it. Under the National Credit Act as well, you know, while interest rates are capped, that kind of short-term loan, they can charge 5% per month, which is 60% per annum. And then there's fees and charges as well. And there's a whole lot of fees which Campbell, works for he's the director of the Legal Aid Clinic at Rhodes, did a really good paper on this. And he's done two, one in 2007 and one in 2016, where he mathematically shows that the fees and charges, you know, while interest might be capped at 60% per annum, the fees and charges on a loan that you're going to pay back in less than 6 months can accumulatively make the interest rate very, very high. So that while it looks small at 5% per month compared to 30% for the Stokvel, it might actually be, you know, in much the same sort of ballpark, bigger. And then it's hidden behind all these different fees and charges. And you don't just see, boom, that's a lump sum interest rate, simple basis, no interest on interest. That's what you pay, 30 rand for the 100 rand.
Okay. So it's definitely stock fails then seem to be a way of lending money from people, and it's unsecured loans, I would imagine.
Yes.
And also helping you if you perhaps are not or blacklisted for some other reason to be able to obtain credit where you wouldn't get one from a bank or a normal lending institution. Once they also applied the test for whether you affordability. Sorry, they just didn't mention the right word. So we've said that they have a form of social security in lending. Do you think they also have an economic function, and that they can also give you some sort of economic security in the future?
Yeah, if you mean by that like a long-term investment in the sense that you might be saving not just to buy a car at the end of the year, but maybe to build wealth over time, or maybe even to save for your retirement.
Yes.
I would say that they do have that. So, often short-term credit, that you might borrow from the micro lender would be bad credit in the sense that you are using it maybe to do your monthly, your shopping for food or something. So they're essentially you're smoothing consumption from period to period. Whereas good credit, I would say, is if you are maybe using it to build onto your house and increase the value of where you live. Or even maybe buy a car, which is a depreciating asset, but you're buying something that maybe you can use to save money over time on transport costs, or to maybe use it in a business, or maybe you're using stockpile capital to grow a business that you did. So we didn't speak to many informal traders, but we did speak one or two who definitely used stockpile capital to grow. The one person ran a tuck shop, and before that she'd run a hair salon, and she definitely used stockpile capital to grow a business. So these are all good things. A very common purpose we came across was that, people would get this big ROSCA payout, 50,000 Rand, 100,000 Rand, whatever it was, and they would use it to build onto, their small home that they had in Khayelitsha, brick and mortar home. They'd build onto it, and people had great homes. And we visited these homes, and, they were very well maintained, very neat, very tidy, and quite big, some of them, with several rooms. People also often still identified as being, from the Eastern Cape, and they would have family there. And instead of building, onto their home in Khayelitsha, there was remits. They would send back a lot of money to the Eastern Cape and develop the family home there for their retirement or where their extended family lived. In terms of saving, for retirement over the long term, I didn't come across that so much. It was more in terms of buying something or building assets in that sense of building wealth. But I do know of one contact of mine, someone called Nikki Swartz, who runs a business called Spoon Money. They run a great thing where they deal with female informal traders who are already in their own stock vels. They have two structures. So there's Spoon Money Pty Limited, which is a registered credit provider and a micro lender. And that's that organization lends business capital to informal traders to grow their businesses. But in order to be able to borrow from Spoon Money Pty Limited, you have to be a member of Spoon Money Stockvel, which is what Nikki calls a super stockvel, where all these informal traders belong, and it's much bigger than, the 12 members or whatever of a normal ROSCA. You would then contribute to that stock fell, and Nikki conceives of this as a long-term savings plan. So you would contribute, and that would be invested in maybe a money markets account or some sort of asset management function where you'd earn interest, decent income on your money, and that would be explained to everyone that this is saving for the long term, and that that for short-term needs, there are other ways, maybe through your personal stock file or through a loan from Spoon Money Pty Limited. So there are different ways of doing this. And I think that given that this is an indigenous way of saving money, that a symbiosis between banks, between asset management companies and stock files is the way forward. And that could well be the future of increasing South African savings rate, particularly long-term savings rate.
That appears to be great work, because it although it's providing short-term capital, it's also focusing on the future of the informal traders so that they have something to fall back on when they're older and can't work anymore by this means of savings.
Totally, totally.
Okay. So we've already discussed that Stockwells can be accessed for credits and loans, and that it fills a much-needed gap in the market because of the difficulty in obtaining loans from banking institutions, etc., and the high interest rates. I just want to focus for a minute about the amount of money involved in Stockwell. So according to Wikipedia, it's estimated that one in every two adult South Africans is a member of at least one of the approximately 820,000 Stockwells. And then South Africans invest approximately 50 billion rand in Stockwells a year. With this amount of money involved, are Stockwells regulated in any way?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a good question. So I started off by saying that these were informal clubs, and I stand by that. They definitely are informal, and they're definitely not regulated in the way that, say, credit unions or friendly societies are regulated, in other countries and indeed in our own country. But Stockwells are not ignored by the South African regulators either. So if we look at it sort of by sort of functional silos, starting off with the banking function. So under the Banks Act, which is the act in this country that deals with deposit-taking institutions, so under the Banks Act, in order to take deposit, which is a defined term under the Act, which definitely involves, you know, collecting money from the public and storing it, to take deposits from members of the public, you have to be, that's part of what is also defined as the business of a bank. And in order to conduct, quote unquote, the business of a bank, you need to be a license. You basically need to be licensed as a bank. You need to be a public company. You need to have a lot of capital on hand. So that's the way the Banks Act is set up. But then there are exemptions. So there are other kinds of banks, first of all. There's cooperative banks, mutual banks, that kind of thing, which have their own regulatory structure. And then there's this exemption notice, which first came out in the 1990s. And latest version is in about 2014, which does two things. It exempts, firstly, what they call cooperative financial institutions, which are a formal structure, like more like a credit union in the north. But then it also exempts more informal clubs. You know, that might be your typical Stockwell. So Stockwells can collect deposits from the members of the public without being registered as a bank, and that is fully permitted under the Banks Act. All that the exemption notice says is that if your Stockwell holds 100,000 rand or more in capital, then it should register with the it's a private body, but it's the oversight body set up under the legislation, which is the National Stockwell Association of South Africa. So that's the Banks Act, the banking function.
Yes.
Then of course we know that Stockwells lend as well, and Stockwells lend to natural persons, which under the relevant consumer lending statute, the National Credit Act, consumers definitely include all loans to natural persons, provided that there is a cost of credit, you know, that you're charging interest on the loan. So when a Stockwell lends to a member who is, of course, a natural person, that would normally be covered by the National Credit Act. So if a loan is covered by the National Credit Act, there's a lot of red tape. I've already mentioned the affordability assessment. The lender would have to register with the National Credit Regulator, which is a is a hurdle that involves time and money and also know-how, that knowing that you have to do that. And if you're not a registered credit provider, then you can't. The loan is an unlawful transaction, and it would be basically viewed as void by a court and completely unenforceable. There's procedural hurdles when it comes to enforcing debts, that, you know, you have to send letters, you have to go to the magistrate's court, all this sort of thing. There's limits on the interest you can charge. There's all sorts of rights that consumers have, plain language, debt review, that kind of thing. Basically, there's a lot of red tape under the National Credit Act, but with a Stockwell, they're exempt from all of that. So, and the wording is important though, right? A loan from a Stockwell to a member of that Stockwell in accordance with the rules of that Stockwell is not considered a credit agreement under the National Credit Act. So you can ignore all that, all those rules I just mentioned.
Yes.
Importantly, however, a loan from a Stokvel member of Stokvel mm-hmm. Capital to a Stokvel non-member falls outside this exemption. So at least in theory, all those rules under the National Credit Act would apply. Yes. So, I mean, I've said how common that transaction is already. And that yes. that is something that that either wasn't considered by the regulators, or you know, is just ignored as being an unreachable, unenforceable part of the informal economy. I mean, yes. what I haven't mentioned is that the registration threshold normally in most countries, you know, certainly I've studied the Australian one, the European one, the English one. In most countries, the National Credit Act or the Consumer Credit Act statute covers only loans from lending businesses to consumers, not from yes. consumers to consumers, as it does in South Africa, and then certainly yes. not every loan from a consumer to consumer. The registration threshold in South Africa is zero. So if I happen to lend you 100 Rand and I wasn't a registered credit provider and I charged interest on that loan, there's no way yes. I could enforce that debt in a court. I would have to resort to some kind of informal pressure in order for the debt to, yes. to recover my money. So that, wow. That's the credit function. Insurance is very complicated. I'll just be super brief here.
Yes.
So we have a new Insurance Act as part of the move towards twin peaks that's been happening since the Financial Sector Regulation Act, which came out in 2017. And then the Insurance Act was part of this move that, that we've now taken. And it's a mostly a prudential act in the sense that it deals with how to run an insurance company, and other requirements as well, transformation, fit and proper persons, that kind of thing. And one of the things that the new Insurance Act does is it creates a framework for micro-insurance. In other words, mm-hmm. insuring typically smaller risks for people who might not otherwise have, you know, taken out insurance. So in the same way that microcredit deals with fringe lending, micro-insurance is supposed to bring more people under the you know the banner of insurance. So funeral insurance might be the classic kind of thing that would be a micro-insurance policy. You know, we've had this long before the Insurance Act, but now there might be a move to bring funeral insurance under the micro-insurance framework. And it's also, it's not just funeral insurance, it's also insurance of property and that kind of thing as well. But I digress. So the point with the micro insurance is that you can now have a micro insurer. So in order to be licensed as a proper full on insurance company is quite hectic. You need to be a public company. You need to have a lot of capital. With a micro insurer, the thresholds are slightly lower. And then even below that, because it might not be, you know, that your Stokvel wants to formalize into being some sort of micro insurance company. You can be a cell in a larger structure. They call that cell captive insurance. So maybe a very large burial society with a fair amount of capital on hand could partner, mm-hmm. you know, with a larger institution like Old Mutual, say, and be a small cell in Old Mutual's business. So they'd have a ring-fenced share of profits and losses in the company, and that would be a way in which Old Mutual could reach into the informal economy through the, you know, essentially the intermediation of a Stokvel. Another way, of course, that you could do this is simply through group policies. You know, group insurance has been around for ages, but normally with employees or trade unions or something. But now, you know, why not sell a group policy to a burial society or something? There's yes. many possibilities, yes. and it's great that South African insurers are starting to think about these things. There's a role under FASE as well. Stokvels are mentioned in FASE and basically yes. exempted in the sense that they're not financial intermediaries. And yeah, so that's the statutes. At case level, there are very few, you know, cases in the South African law reports dealing with Stokvels. If you do a keyword mm-hmm. search on an online database, you'll get very few hits.
Yes.
I only know of one that deals with a classic ASCRA in the sense of a lending Stokvel, and it's about enforcing debts through that Stokvel. And that's a case from 2006 in the PE High Court, called him D versus Malchus, and that deals with, yeah, it's an ASCRA, but it was due, given the time periods, it was before the National Credit Act, it was decided under the Usury Act. Interesting case. Yeah. And then at ADR level, you know, like sometimes the ombuds deal with cases involving burial society. I've seen a few decisions of the phase on that, for example, dealing with burial societies.
Yes.
So
you could definitely say that stock fails are regulated, but not regulated to death.
They're regulated in the sense of they're mentioned in the statutes normally and defined. There's a clear definition in the Banks Act, which is repeated in the National Credit Act, of what a stock fail is, but they're defined in order to exempt them, within certain limits, which is good, I think, because that gives that allows these institutions to function as the financial institutions of the informal economy. And I don't think you would be able to effectively enforce any kind of regulation. I mean, we've seen with the Khayelitsha policing report in 2014 that law enforcement just doesn't really reach into Khayelitsha or other informal settlements. And, to try and then regulate an indigenous practice that's very widespread would not be great for the rule of law, I don't think, because those laws would just be unenforceable and ignored in the large part.
Of course, yes. No, you're quite correct. So, Andrew, you recently wrote a piece on how South African stokvels manage their lending activities outside the courts. Could you take us through this and what you found?
Yeah, so it was an empirical study, and I spoke a bit about our data set. We did interviews in Khayelitsha, mostly in the Harare area of Khayelitsha, so quite a concentrated group of people. Our people that we spoke to were fairly homogenous. It was mostly women, mostly older women, and mostly isiXhosa women, many of whom identified as being from the Eastern Cape originally. And the focus of our study, so, I mean, there are many stokvel studies by all kinds of different people, by economists, sociologists, anthropologists, all with a slightly different research question based on what their particular field of inquiry is. Because we are lawyers, in our team, I wanted it to be, to be a legal one. So I wanted to know what norms govern Khayelitsha stokvels, and particularly I wanted to know what the role of contracts was, because, as you said at the outset, that's what I'm interested in. And what we found was that, they talk in social legal literature about something called private ordering, in the sense that as opposed to state ordering, where the state is heavily involved in regulating a group of people or a particular activity. With private ordering, people run the show themselves, and in fact, contract is generally in most societies is a form of private ordering, in the sense that you agree on your relationship in the contract, and your rights and duties then govern your relationship going forward. And in fact, we know from many studies around the world that with most contracts, that's the end of it. The contracts don't see the inside of a court unless things go really wrong. What we found in our study, I would argue that the constitution of a stokvel is a kind of contract, like a multilateral contract, if you like, that everyone signs into, and that there were quite detailed provisions for agreeing to this. That might be that you have to sign it and make it even an affidavit, even at the police station, or that there'd be some sort of ceremony where it was read out to you and then you verbally agreed to it in front of the club. But that these constitutions had rules, and that those rules were viewed as binding on members, and that the debts incurred, whether it's to a loan borrowed from the stokvel or because you've had your ROSCA payment earlier in the cycle so that you owe other members of the club, their share of the money, that those debts were viewed as binding, and in the most part were paid, if not on time, they were paid eventually by members. So in our data set, we only spoke to 20 people, and there were fairly homogenous groups, mostly our friends, neighbors, people who are well-known and trusted by each other. Very few clubs reported having defaults. So most people, while they might have a story that was of a hearsay nature, this club of my friend somewhere else, we heard about this, most people said that their club worked fine. Everyone paid eventually. But people did also have stories, it might be rules in the stokvel or in the stokvel constitution or else, just generally accepted practice in their group that, if you don't pay, this is what will happen. So everyone said stokvel debts are binding. If you don't pay, one person said, then we go to your family members and, someone must pay the debt. But we do recognize you might be unemployed temporarily. You might have a death in the family. There might be costs. And then, if you are honest with us and you negotiate, then we can talk about it. But eventually the debt will have to be paid, and either it'll be, through a negotiated settlement or group peer pressure, reputational mechanisms, shaming, even possibly more forcible things. Some people spoke about seizing property to pay Storkfeld debts, normally without, you know, that of course would be, that is done in the formal sector too, but you have to have court sanction for it to be lawful.
Of course.
But this would be done extracurricularly. And that's why you had the affidavit at the police station, so that at least in theory, the police wouldn't think that you were robbing this person's house. But when we said, you know, have you ever considered, you know, maybe going to the small claims court or the magistrate's court, there was only one person out of all the people we spoke to who had ever done that. And most people, you know, one person actually said, you know, this is not our law. We don't do things like this. If you do that, you know, you're causing a fight with the whole Storkfell. Yeah. So people preferred not to go to the courts. It would be resolved either, you know, through group pressure, one-on-one pressure. Some people mentioned sort of the township dispute resolution structures, like they have street committees, and you might go there. Or people mentioned the taxi, the taxi men, you know, the local taxi bosses who, it turns out, seem to have some sort of, you know, be ADR agents almost, if you like, working in the community, that for a fee they would come and discuss with the person. And no doubt that's pretty intimidating when the taxi bosses come to your house. They would agree on a payment plan and that it would be sorted out like that. But the view we heard from most people was that the courts take too long, it's unsuccessful. As you heard, there are complications of the National Credit Act sometimes. The taxi guys, it costs a lot of money, you know, they don't always enforce it afterwards, there's a payment plan, but you know, you gotta keep calling them back and paying the money to get that enforcement. But the thing that works best is to, you know, work person to person, use relational means to enforce debts.
It's amazing that such a big industry where so much money is passing through everyone's hands is dealt with successfully, it appears, on such an informal basis.
Yeah, and totally. And that's what that comes down to, is being careful who you choose to be a member of a club.
Exactly.
And that's where you see the things that I've already mentioned, that, for example, if you're a new member, then you probably go last in the ROSCA cycle because you haven't proved over many years that you pay your debts. Or you have that ASCRA pool on the side of your ROSCA, so that if you default, there's at least a pool of collateral which the club can seize to pay the money that you owe to them. You know, there's lots of clever things that have been worked out over the years to manage the risk of default.
Yes, because let's face it, the whole legal procedure for recovery of debt is very frustrating.
Oh yeah. And you know, the money involved as well. Even if you represent yourself, you got to probably take a day or two of work to go to court.
Yes.
And if you want to get lawyers involved, you know, that's just not going to be completely outside of the budget of all the people that we spoke to.
Of course, yes. And it's very easy for the debtor to plead poverty in the magistrate's court and say, well, he doesn't earn enough to pay back the money and we'll pay it back at 5 rand a month type of thing. So it is extremely frustrating. Andrew, this has been fascinating. I just wondered if you could give some last thoughts on how possibly COVID-19 and the whole lockdown situation has been affecting Storkfells, especially if you think of the older members who are perhaps not tech savvy yet and have been collecting things in cash.
Yeah, so I mean, what I say is going to be speculation. So we did our data collection in 2018, and I have no current data on that. I read on National Storkfell Association of South Africa, NASASA's website, a whole lot of guidance about what you should or shouldn't be doing in your Storkfell in a time of COVID. Whether people are reading that or not, I'm not sure. So my sense, and this is my own guess, is that if you are transacting by EFTs, then that's fine. Your Storkfell can continue, you know, as you want, without face-to-face meetings. If you are this kind of Storkfell that transacts in cash, then that's more problematic. But it's particularly problematic because it depends what your cycle is, right? So lockdown started here on the 27th of March. And if your Storkfell was running from January or maybe even from last year, and, you know, halfway through the cycle, you can't just suddenly stop with some people having received an interest-free loan and others being owed money. I can't imagine that people would be satisfied to just go without money, you know, for however long it takes to settle COVID. But so I don't know. And we know that law enforcement doesn't stretch into Khayelitsha very well. But this is all speculation, and I really just don't know, I'm guessing.
Yes. Okay, that's great. Andrew, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us and answering my questions. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Irene. It's been great to have this opportunity.
Wonderful. Thank you.